Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. When we talk about enemies domestic, when we talk about, for that matter, enemies foreign, a unifying theme is the effort to take down our country that some outside of this country, and it certainly seems some inside it, have in mind for us. We're going to talk in the course of this hour with an individual who has an extraordinary pedigree with insights into both the enemies, foreign and domestic, what they're up to, what they're doing, for that matter, together to accomplish this goal of essentially destroying the United States, certainly as we have known it. His name is Dr. Michael Rechtenwald. He was, for a time, a very highly regarded, very leftist professor at New York University. He began questioning some of the tactics of those in his ranks and was, in short order, outed and essentially driven from the university. He is the author of 11 books, I believe, at last count, including Thought Criminal, which describes some of his ordeals, Beyond Woke. And he is the author of a forthcoming book, which I am anticipating with great enthusiasm, The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty. Dr. Rechtenwald, thank you for giving us generously of your time today to drill down on some of the issues that I know you've been wrestling with. And thanks to your background as a, well, champion of Marxism, I think you have truly some very important, if not actually unique, perspectives on. We're glad to have you with us once again at Securing America, sir.
Thanks to be here. Thank you very much.
Part of what I want to talk with you about, Dr. Rechtenwald, is informed by what we were treated to last week in the form of President Joe Biden's speech at Independence Hall. It's gotten a lot of attention, a lot of controversy now surrounding it. I'd be very interested in your perspective, both on kind of the subliminal messaging of the scene that was set, but also the extent to which we are, in fact, looking at, well, something that in terms of its content was deeply problematic as well.
Yeah, for sure. I think the starting with the subliminal, or I should say, I think almost explicit messaging coming through the visual semantics and semiotics of the speech. We're looking at Biden standing before Liberty Hall and with a red light beaming and the unequivocal appearance of hellfire. And then the glowing gloves of military officers standing behind him, which to me suggests two things. One, and this goes in conjunction with what he said, but the thing that it suggested to me is that his political opposition can expect hellfire, that they can expect to be treated to a kind of damnation by the political establishment. And the military installation behind him, the two officers, one whose glove was rather inordinately glowing, seemed to suggest to me that military force was not out of the question in suppressing this dissident contingent of the population. So I saw this the symbolics as extremely scary, frankly, quite attempting to be quite scary, I should say. It was attempting to intimidate and attempting to make suggestions that this kind of dissidence will not be tolerated and that it will be met with some significant opposition and from the state, from the establishment, etc.,
including the use of force. And let me just ask, before we get to what was further amplified by the speech itself, Doctor, is there any doubt in your mind that all of those messages were intentional, not simply an accident.
I can't imagine that there was any accident there. I believe that you have a president addressing the nation. All the semiotics are going to be considered in advance. This cannot be accidental. So this was definitely purposeful, and it was meant for a purpose. It was meant for a reason. It meant to give off particular messaging. And so it's no less intentional than the actual content of the speech.
Okay, well, let's turn to that, because I think this simply reinforces your insight. When you listened to the speech, there were some lines that were clearly designed to soften somewhat the more forceful ones, shall we say. But I think the key money quotes were very much directed at a political opposition that, the way he described it, would seem to number in the millions, if not actually tens of millions, of Americans. Give us a sense of what you took away from the speech yourself.
Yeah, I mean, he declared that the, quote, MAGA Republicans represented a, quote, threat to the Republic, and then as such that they are basically beyond the pale of political representation. They should not be considered a legitimate political contingent. They should be isolated. They should be shunned. They should be othered. They should be effectively cordoned off and deemed completely illegitimate and even criminal, I would say.
Wow. And again, I'm speaking to a man who has, by virtue of previous study and ideological affinity, an appreciation for what those kinds of semantics or rhetoric mean in the tradition of totalitarian repression. Yeah. So you're not throwing these words around lightly. These are words that are simply unmistakably fraught, are they not?
Yes. I mean, this comes from studying the history of communist regimes in the Soviet Union, China, and elsewhere. And everything about this speech was very typical, for example, of Soviet rhetoric that deemed the political oppositionists to be deviationists and effectively sent to the gulag, or if not shot in the back of the head or the front. So this is the kind of rhetoric we can expect from a Sovietized state, a state that's bent on total repression, if not elimination, of its opposition, and to make it politically illegal to hold such views.
Yeah. And as some of our colleagues have pointed out, using this sort of imagery, making these sorts of threats at the birthplace of freedom in this country, Independence Hall, adds tremendously to the, well, the infamy, I would say, but also to the significance of this address. Dr. Rechtenwald, well, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want to drill down a little bit further on something you alluded to that I think is very relevant here. Othering is a term that I want our audience to really understand what exactly that entails, and if you happen to be another, what you can expect. We'll visit with Dr. Michael Rechtenwald about all of that and more straight ahead. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The people of Chile just delivered a stunning rebuke to the communist they elected as president last year, Gabriel Boric. Call it buyer's remorse. In a referendum Sunday, fully 61% of voters rejected a new leftist constitution Boric strongly supported. It represents the first significant setback to the red tsunami that has seen one after another of our hemisphere's nations entrust power to the not-so-tender mercies of communists. The question is not only whether a better constitution will now emerge in Chile, one that will actually check Boric's bid to effect what Barack Obama would call the fundamental transformation of that country. Even more important is whether the Chilean electorate's second thoughts will encourage voters in Brazil, the last major free nation in the region, to spare their nation the restoration in November of another dangerous communist, felonious ex-president Lula da Silva. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. Our guest is Dr. Michael Rechtenwald. I'm very pleased to say for this full hour, we're going to deeply drill down on, well, what Joe Biden himself said in the course of his speech in Philadelphia last week is not normal in America today. And we're taking stock of what isn't normal, starting with his speech itself, but going more broadly in a moment, with a man who has both studied and, frankly, in the past, embraced the sorts of totalitarian or ideologically repressive regimes that we have long opposed in this country and now seem to find ourselves the prospect of, at least, facing here at home. And Dr. Rechtenwald, I wanted to pick up on something you touched on in passing in your very powerful, well, really, denunciation of President Biden's speech at Independence Hall. You use the term othering, and I'd like you to define that term, if you would. What it means in practice, especially for those who find themselves characterized as the other.
Yeah, I mean, othering is a way of alienating a person and or a body of people from the legitimate body of citizens. It's a way of casting them aside. They become abject, thrown out, and as such, demonized, vilified, and even criminalized. You know, examples in history, of course, are the Jews in Nazi Germany, but also in the Soviet Union, the Kulaks, the Cossacks, and the capitalist class, any kind of representation of the earlier regimes get banished and punished. So it is a very typical ploy of this kind of a totalitarian regime, which I think is what we're up against, actually. And this is what they do. They, once they take power, usually through revolutionary coup, they have to expel their enemies because these enemies represent a threat to their illegitimate power. And they make all crimes political crimes. And the only kind of crime you can commit is actually a political crime. They typically let their own followers, their own contingent, run rampant over the population. And deem their crime to be legal. So, you know, we've seen all of that happening in our short 2-year interim here since Biden has been in office.
I've had it described by others as a kind of 4-step process where, you know, you identify and begin vilifying the other. You begin treating them thereby as in a separate category and the object of humiliation and, as I say, vitriol. And then you strip them of their rights, And then if nature takes its full course, you deprive them not only of their liberty, but in some cases of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds unbelievable, of course, in a society like ours. And yet, what I value so much about your expertise, Dr. Rechtenwald, and your background is that, you know, you've actually studied and seen the practice of this. Is this how it happens in free societies where they're essentially taken down through a process like this othering?
Yes, this is how it happens. And, you know, this is historically how communism looks, actually. It doesn't look like the Marxists believe it looks. That is, that the whole working class or some body of the people is suddenly in power and taking over everything. Instead, what we see is a kind of dictatorial stance taken by the party over the whole population, and this separation of the other from that body politic, and their denunciation, dehumanization eventually. The dehumanization is the step that's necessary before taking actual action against them in terms of whether that be violence or imprisonment or other types of action. Basically, he's justifying any kind of reproach or violence against his political opposition.
And yet there was one of those throwaway lines in the course of the speech in which he said political violence is not acceptable, not never, not under any circumstances.
Right.
And yet the overall thrust of the speech, to say nothing of our experience with, well, the Biden-Harris ticket, among other things, in 2020 was political violence is absolutely permissible, laudable, if used for the right purposes, not by the right, but by the left. And so at the end of the day, I guess what I'm getting at is, did you regard that this speech of President Biden in front of Independence Hall really came down to a not too subtle invitation to violence against the president's political foes?
Yeah, I think that can be definitely, validly construed from the whole context of the speech, the semiotics of it, the actual semantics, and the tone. It looks to me like it's a justification for any kind of retaliation against this group. Certainly verbal humiliation and denigration, which we've been subject to for, since Trump's emergence, really. But further, I think even physical force, because we saw, and this never gets taken into account in Biden's appraisals of the political scenario, is all the violence that took place and was encouraged, not only encouraged, but funded by virtue of bails and so forth, bailing out these violent protesters, so-called, from jail.
So they could get back in the fight.
So we saw this encouragement of violence, and everybody knows the history here. So the implicit message is an endorsement of that. It's not violence from the political establishment's foot soldiers that is condemned. It's violence from the opposition. As I said, there's no law that applies to those people that support the regime. The law only applies to the opponents.
No equal justice under law.
Not at all.
Let me just say, the thing that you've just described here is chilling, even if it were confined to a small number of people, or even a group, let's just say for the purpose of discussion, that would self-identify as MAGA. Make America Great Again supporters. But really, the text of that speech, despite, you know, the deflections and the fuzzing up, particularly after the fact by President Biden himself, really described tens of millions of Americans, arguably everybody who voted for Donald Trump and anybody who, you know, promotes the right to life or who disagrees with, you know, his COVID mandate policy or any number of things. It's a huge percentage of the population, in other words, making more chilling, all the more chilling, I should say, threats that are now being made against them. Dr. Michael Reckonwald, we have to take another break. When we come back, I want to ask you about that COVID element of this and the extent to which it has proven to be a tool in the kit bag of the people seeking to repress this large block of us, indeed the whole country. That and much more with the author of Thought Criminal, Dr. Michael Reckonwald, right after this.
Black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back to a fascinating, if chilling, conversation with a man who knows Marxism from, I'm fond of saying, inside the belly of the beast. He was a professor at New York University who embraced that ideology and championed it and found himself on the outs when he began questioning some of its methodologies and techniques. And has become now, I think, one of the clearest, most articulate, and I hope most impactful critics of Marxism, which he now sees very much on the march in our country today. We've been talking about, in the program thus far, Dr. Reckonwald, your impressions and, well, more than impressions, your informed analysis of both what were the symbolic messages being sent at the Philadelphia address the president made Thursday of last week, and also the statements that he made in the course of his remarks there. There is a kind of inversion of reality that's going on here, I think is fair to say. And I'd like you to tease that out for us and how that fits into the ideological character of what we're now confronting.
Yes, that's right. I think there's an inversion ideology that's in play. That is that what is up is down and what is down is up. This is the way that totalitarians speak. It's what they do to reality is that they speak about violence from one contingent that's not actually performing it, and they dismiss the violence of another contingent that is actually performing it. So what they're doing, they're accusing you of doing, and what they're not doing, they're accusing you of not doing. So basically, this is a complete inversion of reality. And we see this in Orwell's 1984, where basically 2 + 2 = 5, and anything they say goes. This is kind of what's called a reverse of blockade, is that they say the opposite of the truth so that getting to access to the truth becomes difficult. This was analyzed by Andrew Lobachevsky in his book on ponerology, political ponerology, or the science of evil in totalitarian regimes. As they reverse the truth, this makes getting to the truth much more difficult for the subject. And that's what's been underway here for some time.
And to the extent that this is right out of the playbook of not just, you know, sort of George Orwell's sort of treatments of communist totalitarianism, but the actual Marxists themselves, this is something you're very familiar with, and it is proven over time to be very effective in undermining the thinking, the clarity that is necessary on the part of free people to resist this kind of pressure. I'd like to, if I can, pivot from that to what seems to me to be a related inversion of reality, namely what has been done to us, and I use that term advisedly, in the name of responding to the so-called SARS-CoV-2 virus and the COVID-19 pandemic that it precipitated. We've had this characterized in a number of different ways. The China model is perhaps the most accurate, in the sense that China essentially established, having unleashed on us this virus in the first place, us here in the United States and the rest of the world, of course, but really essentially set the standard, which was promoted not only by Beijing, but by the World Health Organization and by acolytes of both, like Tony Fauci, acolytes and laborers like Tony Fauci. Talk us through what the techniques that were used, from lockdowns to mask mandates to, you know, social distancing to vaccines of an untested character to vaccine mandates and passports, what all of that meant, Dr. Rechtenwald, in terms of moving us inexorably in the direction of a totalitarian system supplanting our constitutional republic.
Yeah, I think it was basically a dry run, a kind of experiment with an effect of its own, but as a kind of case test scenario to see just what kind of repressive apparatuses could be applied and what would be tolerated and to what extent. So the model was China. China modeled the lockdowns. And this became universalized across the planet. They provided this so-called lockdown that they claim to have been successful. And we don't know what really numbers come out of China, what we can make of them at all, since they completely fabricate most of what they say in terms of reality. So that was used as a model to roll out across the planet. And they collaborated, I should say, though, with some other elements of the West in the World Economic Forum. And they had run tests that previewed the response to a novel coronavirus just 2 months before the virus was unleashed. So there's
Event 201.
So there's been coordination here. But I think they basically modeled the lockdowns and everything after China, well, that sort of gave validation to the approach, which then became normalized as such across the globe. And the masking, all of these artifices of repression, and all of them shown to be utterly ineffectual in terms of the actual virus, and even the vaccine mandates, which put many people out of work and ruin their lives. This is part and parcel of abrogating our individual sovereignty of self, that is our bodily autonomy. And once you do that, you have ownership over the subject.
This is so important, Dr. Rechtenwald, because I think what many of us have experienced, though we may not be conscious of it as much as we need to be, is not just, as you say, the personal impacts in one's life, whether it's physical, perhaps loss of family members, the impact economically, whether it's losing your job or simply having much harm done to you in terms of your quality of life, but not least the loss of your freedoms. And this really does, it seems to me, constitute a huge win for the Chinese Communist Party in terms of trying to both insinuate its model, if you will, its totalitarian system inside our country, and make it normal, as you say. Normalizing it is a big part of this. There's a lot of talk of late, and I'd be interested in your thoughts about it, perhaps on the other side of our next short break. But I let's get started with it now. Something that's been called mass formation psychosis, by Matthias Desmet, among others, is a very interesting aspect of how this fits into the larger sort of, well, going back to that earlier metaphor, playbook of totalitarians. Can you walk us through that, how that works, and is that, in fact, how you see it happening here?
Yes, mass psychosis formation is a public, is a public and a collective psychosis, in effect, that's induced on a population through a propaganda, and it especially is effective when it's accompanied by fear. What happens is that this subject population effectively buys into a collective psychosis by virtue of adopting the exact formula for a way of thinking about what's happening to them, then begins to act on behalf on the part of this. They begin to act the part of an induced psychotic mass. It's a mass formation, and it reinforces itself by virtue of the compliance of the others. So another person's compliance and other people's compliance reinforces the compliance, and it makes non-compliance more dangerous. And likewise, you get a whole population basically believing a kind of hysterical myth and subject them themselves. And this is something that some of the dissidents from the Eastern Bloc talked about, is the way that totalitarian regimes don't act strictly by virtue of dictating from the top down. They enroll the subject into their own regimes, and the subject becomes part and parcel of the repressive apparatuses. So you're not only repressed by the state and its agents, but you're also repressed by your fellow citizens. Yes. This is what they do.
And it goes back, I guess, to that othering business where you don't want to be outside of the collective, and the willingness of people to submit their freedoms, to submit their sovereignty, as you've put it, to be part of something that makes them feel more comfortable, more secure. The collective is a very powerful kind of, Matthias Desmet has called it, kind of hypnosis, really, of large numbers of people. We have to take a short break. We're going to come right back with more with Dr. Rechtenwald, and we're going to talk a little about green policies and whether they're part of the psychosis as well, right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The people of Chile just delivered a stunning rebuke to the communist they elected as president last year, Gabriel Boric. Call it buyer's remorse. In a referendum Sunday, fully 61% of voters rejected a new leftist constitution Boric strongly supported. It represents the first significant setback to the red tsunami that has seen one after another of our hemisphere's nations entrust power to the not-so-tender mercies of communists. The question is not only whether a better constitution will now emerge in Chile, one that will actually check Boric's bid to effect what Barack Obama would call the fundamental transformation of that country. Even more important is whether the Chilean electorate's second thoughts will encourage voters in Brazil, the last major free nation in the region, to spare their nation the restoration in November of another dangerous communist, felonious ex-president Lula da Silva. This is Frank Affney. Back. We're continuing our hour-long conversation with a very special guest, a man whose insights into what is going on in our country today, what Joe Biden himself says is not normal in America, actually is about who is perpetrating it and the techniques that they're using to do it. We've just explored the term of mass formation psychosis and a sort of practice in the hands of skilled totalitarians, Marxists, whatever, to induce populations to conform to the dictates of the leader and to punish those who fail to do so. This seems to be part of a program that goes by different names. The Green New Deal is one way of describing it. It's a global reset with respect specifically to energy policies. And some astute observers, including a friend of mine, Tucker Carlson, have been pointing out that the practical effect of societies, whether it's Sri Lanka or whether it's the Netherlands or whether it's Europe more generally or arguably us, conforming to these ideas that man is responsible for climate change and only the most, extreme steps aimed at reducing our use of fossil fuels will prevent, cataclysmic problems for the globe and for its populations. I know you've been studying this phenomenon as well, Dr. Rechtenwald. Again, our guest is Dr. Michael Rechtenwald, and we're talking with him from the perspective of a former Marxist about whether this too is a tool for achieving really the takedown of freedom-loving societies like our constitutional republic to the advantage of those who seek to consolidate power and wield it in a most undemocratic way. Give us your thoughts on the Green New Deal, et cetera, if you would, Dr.
Yes, well, I've been writing about this at present, and one of the most salient comparisons I think one can make is to compare it to, actually, the Great Leap Forward under Mao, and that is that this kind of induced, ideologically induced behavior that is utterly world-shattering for those who adopt it. This kind of imposition of ideology on all human activity. And this is what's happening with reference to so-called climate change, which I'm not afraid to say, and I have absolutely no fear of being contradicted by any real evidence, that it is an ideological, not a scientific formation. That it is not being ushered in under real science, but it's actually a construction to induce a particular set of behaviors on the part of the population.
Well, going back to what you talked about in the last block, about the protocols that were applied in response to the COVID pandemic, you didn't quite put it this way, but it sounds as though you would agree that, much as with the climate issue, this isn't about science, how we responded to that virus either. This was about power. This was about control. This was about conforming to certain dictates. And when you talk about it in the context of energy, what I think Tucker, among others, have been so insightful in warning of is that the knock-on effects of compelling people to comply with your edicts, not yours, but the edicts that are being handed down now to us, with respect to raising your thermostat. And if you don't do it, they'll cause your thermostat to do it automatically if you have one of these new e-thermostats, or the extent to which you will be compelled to use less fossil fuel because the price of gasoline or home heating oil or what have you is simply unsupportable. There's some estimates that 20 million people in this country cannot make their payments on their electricity bills and are at risk of, you know, having them shut off. All of this would seem to me, at least, to be some form of population control that has political motivations, not scientific ones, as you say. And would you agree that the likely consequence of all of this is that that you will see people, you know, perhaps not only facing unbelievable erosions in their quality of life, but perhaps, you know, unable to feed their families or heat their homes, maybe not in this country, but certainly in some others, notably in Europe?
Absolutely. This could be, you know, the great leap forward in China and induce the largest famine in history, the worst famine in history. This, if it's rolled out in its completion, promises to induce famine across the globe, frankly. Not in every case, not in every country, but in parts of every country, and especially amongst the already beleaguered populations of the poor. So because the energy prices will be driven up, because the scarcity of agricultural products will be because the agricultural changes they're implementing will lead to agricultural shortages, to food shortages, because it'll drive up energy prices for all elements of life, including home heating, cooling, and mobility. This will make, of its own accord, it will serve as a kind of lockdown in effect, and it will put people in a kind of a prison. It'll imprison them in a kind of immobile scenario, basically. And then, you know, the World Economic Forum has their way, will be everybody that effectively will be relegated to the metaverse, where they'll experience their only real experience of real life. So they're immobilized, they're driven into a static, no prospect future, and then treated to a metaverse simulation.
A great reset indeed, perhaps of the transhuman character as well. We're going to talk about that and much more with the author of the forthcoming book, The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty, Dr. Michael Rechtenwald, and also about another force very much at work in all of this, the Chinese Communist Party, right after this. We're back for our final round with Dr. Michael Rechtenwald, the author of Thought Criminal and Beyond Woke, and the forthcoming book, The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty, coming out in January. You'll be able to pre-order it in December. We will be talking more about it in due course, I'm sure. Dr. Michael Rechtenwald is the author, a former New York University professor and Marxist at that, who has now become a champion of freedom in our country, very well equipped to warn us about what his former comrades have in mind for us. And he's been doing so in the course of this program. And Michael, I wanted to sort of wrap this up by talking a little bit about how the forces that you mentioned a moment ago, Davos, the World Economic Forum for shorthand, the globalists here and elsewhere, and the Chinese Communist Party are seemingly making common cause, despite what presumably are different end states they have in mind, towards the shared end of taking down the country that is the principal impediment to the realization of their goals of global domination of one kind or another. How is that playing out? Are they in fact able to make common cause? And what are the dangers if they succeed in doing so?
Well, I think one way to look at it is that China is the model for what these globalists out of the World Economic Forum and all the other NGOs that are that they're derived from, you know, going all the way back to the CFR and so forth.
Council on Foreign Relations.
Mm-hmm. Yes. They seem to be choreographing this with China in mind as a model, and also looking at China as a possible tool to implement it. So I think China becomes a kind of handy weapon to use against this sovereign nation and its people. China is a model and a weapon that's being implemented.
And the Chinese Communist Party, of course, has its own interests in doing just
that agenda
as well.
So they have their own agenda, and they're certainly willing to cooperate in this particular undertaking because it benefits them. Whether who actually establishes the global order in the end is a question that I can't adjudicate. It's just beyond comprehension, and I wouldn't want to make a prognosis about that.
But I do want to ask you, I think you've shared with me before in a different setting, Doctor, that the tradition of communists is to liquidate their partners should they get to a point where they've been successful in dealing with their common enemy. Would you expect to see these globalists put up against the wall and
dispensed with, I think,
in that fashion?
They could very well become the useful idiots in the end. Who propagate the ideology and carry out the functions that are asked for, and then effectively disappear. This could be the actual game plan of China.
I think it's a bankable proposition myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let me talk to you a little bit more, knowing your insights into the world of Marxists like the Chinese communists. They have made a very concerted effort in our country, Joe Biden and his family being just one example of it, of what I guess their term for it is elite capture. Mm-hmm. And it's part of sort of a larger influence operation promoted and enabled in part by their propaganda arms, of course, their diplomats, but not least their United Front Work Department. Do you see the fine hand of the United Front Work Department at work in America today in advancing this takedown of our country?
Yeah, I think you're seeing a kind of a capture of the elite by China using shared ideology and shared objectives, you see a kind of elite capture, as you put it. They're looking at this elite and thinking that they can be used, and they're being used to this effect.
And to the extent that we turn a blind eye to this, it seems to me we invite, our destruction from within. And I guess that's where I come down on this whole question of can we permit, if, as our Team B3 at the Center for Security Policy has described it, a country that is at war with us, namely the Chinese Communist Party, China that it rules, to have help from elites in this country with impunity, we're sealing our death warrant, it seems to me. There has to be accountability, and there has to be, well, some kind of purge, I would think, of people, particularly in political power at the moment, who are compromised by and otherwise seen to be aiding and abetting the Chinese Communist Party, no?
Yeah, I'm afraid that our mission really is to first defeat this elite, these subversive elites from that are within first. We have to overcome them in order to reestablish and firm up the sovereignty of the United States itself against its external enemies. So the real task lying before us is first to win back the country from these elites. This kind of we've had a kind of a revolution by elites here, and to first vanquish them so that we can then fend off our foreign adversary.
Amen. Well, and this couldn't be more important given all that we've just talked about in the course of this hour, the aggressive way in which those elites now, particularly in the form of the Biden administration, it seems, are determined to vanquish us.
Yes.
Those who love freedom, and there are a lot more of us, I believe, than there are of them. So we must take up this cudgel right away, in a nonviolent way, of course. Dr. Michael Rechterwald, thank you for your insights. Thank you for the courage that you exhibit in sharing them. We so appreciate your time and hope that we will have you back with updates in the near future. In the meantime, we look forward with great expectation to the Great Reset and the struggle for liberty. This is describing our time, isn't it? God bless you, sir. Come back to us soon for the next edition of Securing America. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for watching.